How to be present and avoid regret with your family is be physically present. Now, you might feel like, man, this is cookies on the bottom shelf, but if it was cookies on the bottom shelf, I wouldn't talk to so many leaders who aren't physically present at home. You have to be physically present. Now, realize that a lot of the things that I'm about to say have to be nuanced, because a couple of the guys yesterday said, hey, you need a hobby, that sort of thing. Actually, Darren Patrick, I was talking to Darren Patrick yesterday, he was speaking and he said, was telling everybody to have a hobby, and some guy from the Sudan stood up and said, so, you know, where we are, our men are getting shot, and people are getting, he said, so what do you think about us? And Darren said, I just basically said, I don't have anything to say. I feel completely humiliated. So Darren was telling us that story yesterday. But as I say this, here's what I want to say. Be physically present. What does that mean? Be careful with the time demands of hobbies. Now, I remember when I first got married. When I first got married, I used to play Ultimate Frisbee two or three nights a week with a group of guys. Because we were 23, and it was, Ultimate Frisbee is a fun game, right? I mean, it's just fun, especially when you're in your 20s. And so I remember a couple of my buddies, right after we got married, and we're playing Ultimate Frisbee tonight. I remember turning, my wife and I had been at work all day. We worked in the same office. I remember turning to her, and I realized things are a little different with me now. I'm not going to play Ultimate Frisbee three or four nights a week, because the importance of being physically present with my wife. Now, I'm not saying to you, you shouldn't have rest patterns in your life. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have any hobby. In fact, it's probably good for you to have some hobby. If you play golf or you enjoy whatever you enjoy doing, that's fine. I'm just saying, when my first two kids were born in Huntington Beach, California, we moved to Huntington Beach when I was 27. We'd come from Los Angeles, moved to Huntington Beach, and for 5 years we lived a mile from the beach, and I never learned to surf. And the primary reason that I never learned to surf is because we had babies, and I thought, I can't figure out how to go surf, be present to my wife and kids, and do that. I just couldn't figure out, and I like to play basketball at the time, so I'd play a couple days a week. I'm just saying, be careful with the time demands of hobbies. Have a hobby, that's fine, but don't be out five nights a week with that hobby. Here's another thing. One of the things that I've started practicing in the last 3 years, do you ever find yourself presented with an opportunity on a given Tuesday night where when one of your friends says, hey, you want to go to a Mariners game tonight? And you think, I love the Mariners. I would love to go to a Mariners game tonight. For me, it's the Los Angeles Clippers. I'm an NBA guy. So if somebody says, you want to go to a Clippers game tonight? I mean, Andrew and I have been to 100 Clippers games. We've sat on the floor. We just went to Madison Square Garden, met the whole team after the game. We've got friends that coach in the NBA. So we've got NBA connections. And so when someone says to me, you want to go to the Clippers game and sit in the fifth row right behind Billy Crystal? My answer is yes, I want to go to the Clippers game. Now, what I realize is sometimes I'm presented with this dilemma of my wife really needs me at home, but I really want to go to the Clippers game, you know, or I really want to go to the Mariners game or the Seahawks game or whatever it is. Again, within reason, I'm not saying don't ever go to a baseball game or a football game, but what I'm about to say is, when in doubt, choose your family. You should write that down or memorize that. Think about that. I'm in doubt, I'm 50-50. Now, again, if you haven't been out of the house in 7 months because you're at home every day from 4 to midnight and your wife is terrified for you to leave, it might be okay for you to go to a Seahawks game after you see the counselor. All right? But what I'm saying is, when in doubt, choose your family. Be physically present. Again, I told you that's cookies on the bottom shelf, but I'm saying as a pastor, be physically present. Having coached so many pastors over the last several years, I oftentimes have guys build out an ideal week. Years ago, I was coaching a guy who had a copy of John Piper's staff manual. So I didn't create this, but he introduced me to this whole idea of three time blocks in a given day, 8 to 12, 1 to 5, and 6 to 10. And apparently, I don't have a copy of Bethlehem Baptist staff manual, but I've heard about this. Apparently, they use this grid with their team. And then they encourage people. They'll say, you know, don't try not to work more than two time blocks in a row. If you work three in a row, take the fourth one off. Only work a certain amount in a given week. It's kind of their grid and structure for guiding their pastoral staff team and how much to work. Sometimes when I'm coaching a leader, he'll turn in he'll build an ideal week or a fixed week or a calendar, and he'll turn it into me, and I can see that he has, you know, men's discipleship on Monday night and elder meetings on Tuesday night and men's leadership on Wednesday night. Now, when you get into high school, when your kids get into high school, and I have two in high school right now and one in middle school and one fifth grader, that schedule will really hurt you. And so what I'm saying right now is be physically present at home. All right, here's the next thing is be emotionally present at home. Number three. How many times have you as a pastor met with somebody who said to you, my dad was home, but he came home, sat on the couch, cracked open a can of beer, put on the game and watched three games in a row, and he was there, but he wasn't there. I've heard that story a lot of times from people over the years. I've heard pastors say that. My dad was there, but he wasn't ever there. Now, we're all cut out differently. For me, I rest by working. You know, people will text me and they'll say things, and I say that sort of tongue in cheek, but people will text me and they're like, do you ever sleep? It's because I love to work. Given the opportunity to watch a movie or work, I would always choose work. I just would rather, like, I can create something, I can write something. And so it's very difficult for me. I'm not applying this necessarily to you. Your struggle may be a bit different, but I think you'll be able to contextualize it. It's very difficult for me sometimes from 5 and 9 to not look at my phone and to not think about I really need to get a blog post published tomorrow, to not think about the fact that somebody in England just texted me because their time is different over there or whatever. And you've got to put away all that technology and be emotionally present. And I don't know what it is for you. What robs you of emotional presence? Is it TV? Is it football? Is it the iPhone? Is it the computer? Is it your... Whatever it is, don't be there, but not be there. And man, I really struggle with this. My 10-year-old, who's super creative, 10-year-old girl, she just ran for the student body president of her elementary school. She finished in second place. She's bitter because she thinks she hit the glass ceiling because a boy won and she didn't win. She says, I didn't win because I'm a girl. She doesn't want Hillary to be president because she wants to be the first woman president. That's what she keeps. That's her. That's just her personality. She's just wired like that in the fifth grade. She's my youngest. And so she's feisty because she's, number four. She will come up to me, look at me in the eyes, and start talking to me. And it feels painful to me sometimes to pull my eyes away from reading the New York Times on my phone or working on that blog post or, oh my gosh, the formatting on this is so bad. And sometimes I just have to go. And a couple times my kids have physically moved my face toward them. And so what I'm saying is don't be there, but not be there. Now, I don't know what your struggle is. It could be something different that keeps you emotionally from being there, but be the chief servant, be physically present, and then be emotionally present. So figure out, what is it with me? If you're like 30 hours a week of NFL football games and nobody ever has access to you, then get the NFL red zone and flip for one game or something, okay? So be emotionally present. Number four is talk about spiritual things continuously. I want to introduce you to, you know, this clearly comes from Deuteronomy 6, and you probably noticed now that this isn't your typical Acts 29 because none of us are preaching. We're doing workshops and so, but in Deuteronomy 6, you all know, if you're a mom or a dad, you know this passage, like talk about these things continuously with your children, you know, in terms of continual spiritual conversation in your family. I want to introduce you to two concepts here. This is sort of a grid that my wife and I have thought about the last 5 years or so. It's daily versus ceremony, right? So think about these two concepts, daily versus ceremony. I know a lot of people that read Wild at Heart 10 years ago, and so they want to have a ceremony for their 13-year-old boy. They're going to, and you've probably read books on this before. It's like, we're going to take this year and we're going to turn him from boy to man. You know, and so he's going to do this, and he's going to do this, and he's going to do this, and then we're going to have a ceremony. We're going to get all the men together and strip them naked and hit them with reeds and make them jump in the lake. And I'm exaggerating, but to say the idea of ceremony is something special. So ceremony is something that I'm not very good at. I'm just not very. My wife is better at ceremony. My wife will say, "You need to like." You need to take Ashley's 14. You need to take her out on this date. You need to do this. You need to do this. She's good at the ceremony part. I'm good at the daily part. So maybe that's why I'm teaching you on it right now. What I would say is daily, all the time, don't look at spiritual things just as ceremony. It's just Sunday morning we talk about spiritual things. Or the 2 days a week that we really do family devotions rather than lying about it that we do it 7 days a week. All right? All the time, look for opportunities in all of your conversations to point your kids to Christ, to point your kids to what God's doing. So all the time, continual conversation. That takes me to number five. And this is 17 years in the making, this point, do something for family devotions. Now, I'm going to talk about this because my kids are now 16, 14, 12, and 10. And some of you are wrestling with like a 5, 3, and 1-year-old. And you got John Piper curriculum out. And you're trying to teach them to hope in God, you know. And so you really just need to show them Bob and Larry, right? And just move on. So that's for those of you that were parenting 10 years ago, the VeggieTales guys. Here's what I want you to remember. Two things. Anything is better than nothing. All right? Unless it's the Book of Mormon, but you get my point. All right? Anything is better than nothing. I'm telling you, I'm a family devotions failure, but we've been doing family devotions for 17 years. But I'm a failure at it. I mean, my wife is driving me to do it. We've been in arguments about 10 or 15 times. She'll be like, so are we going to do something tonight for family devotions? I'm like, why are you trying to take over? You know, I was going to do it. You know? So, and the reality is that if she didn't say that to me, we wouldn't have done it as often because I'm thinking about my blog post or something, you know? And so I am both a failure and a success at family devotions. I'm a failure in that we, in 17 years, have had stretches for a month when we did nothing. But we've stuck with it for 17 years. You know, we've read through the Psalms together as a family probably 10 times. Every chapter, every kid, one verse at a time. I mean, getting in fights while we do it. You've been there. You know, like, read it now, you know? And then we would make our kids share something, you know? You share something that sticks out to you afterwards. And, you know, they would all say, oh, he took mine. I'm like, why can't you find a new one? There's 79 verses in that psalm, you know? So, you know what? You've been there with family devotions. So, I wanted to say to you, anything is better than nothing. It almost doesn't matter what you do. So, you don't have to fight for, like, the perfect gospel-centered, yeah, we'll do Sally Lloyd-Jones again. We've done that, like, 5 to 10 times. We just started it again and quit for the 79th time, you know? And then we did the New City Catechism with our kids at dinner, and we did like 9 of those, and that didn't work very well. So then we're constantly, so anything is better than nothing. And then the second thing I want to say to you about this is stay in it. Just stay in it. Just stay. We haven't done it in 2 months. Well, do it tomorrow. Just stay in it. Don't be a legalist. You don't have to do it 7 days a week. Stay in it. We just recently realized it's more important now than ever. Because our kids can all read, and they can all understand what the Bible says. And here I am preaching all the time and speaking to people all the time. If I don't teach my kids those things, now look, they're not 5, 3, and 1. Like, they can understand them. My son can understand the content in these sessions. He said yesterday, he's like, I'm kind of overwhelmed. That was a lot of stuff to take in. I said, well, you don't have to listen to every session. He said, I can't help but listen. That's what he said to me. He said, it's kind of interesting, but I can't really apply it. He is 16 years old. They're old enough to catch that. Like, if you have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old, you got a lot of years ahead of you now. I feel like right now, we're starting all over again. The best analogy I have for this is, you know, if you just save $100 or $200 a month starting when you're 25 years old, when you're 65, you'll have a lot of money. And if you miss a couple months, you don't go up, never going to save any money again, I'm done. That just didn't work, that money-saving thing. No, I would say stay in it. All right, so with family devotions, anything is better than nothing, and just stay in it. Just the other day, Shander said to me, my wife said to me, let's do something tonight. This is going to be recorded, but if I'm just being honest, we probably get to this about 3 nights a week. We've set goals for years to do it 7 nights a week. Our daughter's in the marching band, which is like the 9th largest world religion, the marching band. So I didn't know anything about the marching band. I just knew that I saw the kids that did that in high school, and I was not doing that. And so, but I'll tell you what, you're really arrogant until you want your daughter to be in the marching band in high school because you're like, that's a great group of kids. I'm kind of glad she's in the marching band because rather than smoking pot behind the bleachers, she's sitting in a costume in the bleachers, you know? So. Just last Friday night, we were at the football game at our local high school where our kids go, and I said to my wife, I just walked into the bathroom, I was afraid, you know, there's teenagers everywhere, you know, trying to hurt me, and they were all dressed in black because it was a blackout night because that's our school colors, and I said, but our daughter's right there in the clarinet section, I love it, all right? We can't do family devotion 7 nights a week, our kids are not home, they're not home every night. We don't quit, you just stay in it, stay in it, stay in it. All right, you do it 100 times this year out of 365 times, that's 100 times that you taught your kids the Bible. All right, with me on that? If you have little kids, you think, man, this guy's a sellout, but I'm saying no, stay in it, all right? You'll see when you have teenagers. All right, number six, I'm speaking to married men. I know you're not all married. I'm speaking to married men because many of you are married. So here's what I want to say to those of you that are married men. Prioritize one-on-one time with your wife. It's a little different than you have to go on a weekly date night. I'm not going to say that to you because I've had guys for years and years and years tell me, we're trying to figure out how to afford that. We can't figure that. So here's what I want to say. Prioritize one-on-one time with your wife. A couple things to think about here. The first thing is you don't have to go spend $75 and get a babysitter to prioritize one-on-one time with your wife. Maybe you can't afford to go on a date night, or you're planning a church in a city where you don't have anybody to watch your kids, and you feel you read somebody's book on this, and you're like, I'm not dating my wife, what should I do? Here's what I would say. You can have a date night at home, put your kids to bed at 8 o'clock at night, or put them in front of a TV show, and don't be a legalist about that. They probably won't become addicted to TV on your date night. So put on a movie, pour a glass of wine, sit on the back porch. If you live where we live in the Western United States, most of us can sit on the back porch, right? So, and have one-on-one time with your wife, and that's not very much money. In the early days, we could not afford, nor did we have babysitting to go on a date night every week, but we never neglected that one-on-one time. One of the premarital counselors that I know, he's a 75-year-old man. He's done premarital counseling, he and his wife, for hundreds of young couples. They make you sign an agreement that you'll spend 30 minutes in uninterrupted conversation with your husband or wife for the entire first year of your marriage. Then they come back to you and check in with you once a month. 30 minutes of uninterrupted conversation. However you do it, prioritize one-on-one time. It doesn't have to be expensive. Now, the second thing I want to say is a few years ago, some of you have been around 829 long enough. I see a few of you that have been around 6, 8, 10 years. You remember when Gary Ricucci came to Sonoma? A few of you. Dave was there. Hunter was there. Harvey was there. Gary and Betsy Ricucci came to our Acts 29 retreat. And Gary taught me something 6 or 7 years ago I've never forgotten about the importance of intentionality in planning. So I want my wife to be happy. And so I get in the car on date night and I say, hey, what do you want to do? Want to go to the beach? We live 8 miles from the beach. You want to go to the beach and go walking? You want to go out to dinner? You want to get sushi? And she'll go, I don't know, what do you want to do? And then we'll sit there for an hour like, I don't know, what do you want to do? I don't know, what do you want to do? And then pretty soon we're mad at each other and date night's ruined. Okay? And we'll end up like eating at Carl's Jr. or something. So, now, not really. But here's the thing. What I have learned is that I honor my wife whether or not married men, you're good at this, you honor your wife by just doing some planning. Some intentional planning. Decide what you're going to do and make a reservation a week in advance. It's the difference between I just happened to be at the grocery store, so I bought my wife a crappy bouquet of flowers for $4 versus I actually put a little thought into a nice gift. All right? The same thing for that one-on-one time. What I would say is intentionally plan that time. Make a plan. Because what you're doing is you're showing your wife, I cared enough to not just get in the car and say, what do you want to do? And you might have been comforting yourself by saying, I want to do what my wife wants to do. But really what you did is you didn't spend 30 minutes planning and calling them and making a reservation or making sure that a movie was ready to put the kids in front of or getting a babysitter there. Don't put that on your wife. Love your wife and care for your wife by planning in advance whether or not it's your personality. No, it's not my personality, so I'm not teaching out of my strength. I'm teaching out of my commitment in this area. Last year, for years and years, we said we don't go out on Valentine's Day because my wife is totally happy with that. She would love to not go out on Valentine's Day. Because every time we try it, there's like 400 people at the restaurant, the food's bad, and everybody's, it just feels like a lot of pressure. So for years, we did Valentine's Day as a family, and she was thrilled with that. We would cook a meal together, but this year, I decided, no, I'm going to really prioritize this. 21 years of marriage, I made a reservation, we went to our favorite restaurant. I told the guys on my coaching cohort, I challenged all of them, let's all do this together this year, like let's, a month in advance, let's plan a good night, and let's honor our wives by doing that. All right, so make a plan, be intentional, prioritize one-on-one time. And lastly, I'm just going to take a couple more minutes, but if you have spent any time with me in the past, you know that I encourage everybody to write some sort of life plan. Now, I know the life plan can feel like a bit of a boxy tool sometimes, so do with it whatever you want. I'm just saying, right now is a great time, and I'm going to give you, well, there they are. I'm going to give you four things that you can do. You don't have to go through some, you know, crazy 29-step process. I'm just saying, and you can read what I've written on this if you want more information, but choose four, not events, but choose four areas or priorities that you want to work on next year. All right, like my family, my marriage, my parenting. And if you email me, I'll send you what I've written on this. I'll send you a more extensive plan that you can walk through. But right now is the time to do it. The week between Christmas and New Year's, ideal time to write a plan for 2016. What are you gonna be? Who are you gonna be in 2016? So choose three or four areas to work on next year in your life. And I'll give you 10 sort of suggestions in what I write in this, and then write a vision statement for each area. So let's say marriage. You're saying marriage is something I really need to give attention to next year. Write a vision statement for each area. So in other words, write a paragraph for who God has called you to be in that area. And write it in the present tense. Write that down, present tense, as if it were true today. I'm a man who loves and leads my wife. I always put my wife first and express love to her as demonstrated in 1 Corinthians 13. Write who God has called you to be. And then write three or four things that you're going to do next year in order to live that out. So what are you going to do next year to be who you say you're going to be? So next year, I'm going to make sure that my wife and I have an intentional date each week. Next year, I'm going to make sure that I take my wife on 2 overnight getaways as a part of building my marriage. Next year, I'm going to make sure to send my wife every Friday morning. I'm going to watch the kids and send her out, if your wife would enjoy this, for 3 hours at a coffee shop by herself or whatever. And then lastly, lots of people can write a good plan and then it sits in the computer, it goes in the drawer. And so once a week, review that and adjust it. Now, my concern for you in this session is to say, let's not let our home life wreck our ministry life. Maybe we should have done this first session. So while you're busy building leaders and creating healthy cultures where we're not isolated in our work environment and making sure that we have healthy rhythms, I want to encourage you to be present with your wife and kids at home so that you avoid regret. Okay, let me pray for us, and then I'll introduce our next speaker. God, I thank you for these men and women in this room, and I thank you for the churches that are being planted through this crew. God, Acts 29 is a lot bigger in the West Coast states than it's ever been. We've got a lot of churches, 100 churches in our 12 states, in the 12 West Coast states. And Lord willing, God, we'll see that number continue to rise as we train up and raise up church leaders. But I also want to see, even more importantly than that, strong marriages, strong fathers, strong mothers, strong husbands. And I pray that every person today in this room would make a commitment of something that they're going to do in order to move this area forward next year. In Jesus' name, amen. Take a minute right now, and I want to encourage you to just write down, just like Josh had you do yesterday. I want to encourage you to write down one or two things that you're going to do in 2016 to move one of these areas forward. Just right now, some commitment that you'll write down, and then I'll introduce our next speaker. I want to introduce to you our next speaker. I don't know how many of you know Sam Tekus, but Sam and I served on the same church staff for 7 or 8 years. I met Sam when he was probably 25 years old, and he was making tons of money in the business world as a 25-year-old guy, was very successful, and came and visited our church. Sam grew up in Hollywood, California, just right outside of downtown LA, and came to our church and quickly dove into leadership. And within a couple of years became an elder. And then I remember I was having lunch with Darren Patrick in the early days of Acts 29. And we had a conversation about this young guy, Sam Tekus. And I remember sitting there in the parking lot, I called Sam and offered him a role in our church staff team. And we offered him $3,000 a month, which was a small, small fraction of what the money he was making at the time. And in the parking lot, right there, Sam said, "I'll take it." And so this was, you know, maybe a decade ago. And so Sam came on our team, became
we became a partnership, really, over 7 or 8 years, and then he served alongside each other. He became my closest friend, and then went and worked for Jeff Vanderstelt at Soma Tacoma for 3 years, and so he's trained a lot of guys. If you've been through Soma School, he's done a lot of training with Soma School. And then about 2 years ago, Sam came back to Los Angeles to plant the church, and so now he's planting a church in the northern Los Angeles County area. The reason I'm having Sam speak on this topic, a couple of things. First of all, Sam has been an amazing model of friendship to me and to my family. And I've watched him lead his family, lead his wife. He's been married for 17 years. He has 3 kids. Our kids are friends. He has teenagers also. And he came out of a rougher background. He didn't come out of a strong family background, but he really understands the value of friendship and giving, what it looks like to give as a friend. So Sam Tekus, could not commend him to you more highly, and I know you'll be blessed by his teaching.
All right. Thank you. I'm still trying to get back pay from Brian for those $3,000. Tell you, he's got money now. So if you need to borrow some money, by the way, he's a good guy to turn to. He's a good friend. Brian and I have been really good friends. Sometimes you get asked to speak on a topic because you're really good at it. And in my case, I got asked to speak because I'm really good friends with Brian. We've been good friends to each other. But and sometimes you get asked to speak on it because you really suck at it, honestly. And sometimes I feel like, if you're wondering, it's really the latter for me. I'm an example of the latter. I don't feel like I have much to offer you, but as I've been praying and preparing for today, I trust the Spirit will encourage you with something today. I used to have friends, and then I became a pastor. This is what I thought of at what I thought at one point in my ministry. Man, I used to have a lot of friends, and then all of a sudden, I was in a situation where I felt rejected even by people that I considered close friends of mine. The men in the church who I saw as my friends were not acting like it. We did ministry together, we hung out together, we went camping together, our kids played together, we threw parties together, poker parties together, you name it, we did it. We did a lot of these things with some of these friends. But when things got tough, I felt like my friends were peeling off. It's like, where are my friends? See, friendships, as some of you already know, are complicated and messy, as it is. But they can be even messier and even more complicated for a pastor in the context of a local church. Think about this. And I learned this really quickly on in ministry. It's a situation, the church pastoring in a local church setting, it's a situation where your friends, your ministry, your family, and your job are all wrapped up into one neat little package. That's a lot of eggs in one basket. Have you guys ever felt that? The tension and the pressure of that? And if I'm being honest, I don't like that at times. I really want to have clear lines of distinction between my friendships, my work, my ministry, all these things, because I feel like I have more control when I have those clear lines of distinction. Because if you screw one of them up, it'll affect the others. Right? Brian said we weren't preaching today. That's a lie. If this bothers you, it's for a good reason. Absent a culture of grace, you could be walking on eggshells all the time. And that's how I felt sometimes, that I was walking on eggshells. I don't want to mess this relationship up because that'll trigger this and that'll trigger that. And so if you have that feeling, if it bothers you, if you feel like you're walking on eggshells trying to preserve all these different relationships for fear of what could come next, it could potentially lead us to react in one of 3 unhealthy ways. Okay, consider these. It could lead us to look for friendships exclusively outside of our churches. And I've known pastors, friends who actually don't want to be friends with anybody in their context, or elders or what have you, anybody. And this is unhealthy because our ministry context will provide us with some of the best opportunities to cultivate friendships. I mean, I look at Josh and Adam. This is my relationship with Brian. So they really do provide us some of the best opportunities to cultivate really good, lifelong friendships. Consider this also. We will hold people at arm's length and only allow ourselves to have shallow relationships and friendships for fear of being hurt or betrayed. You ever felt that? You know, I'm just going to keep some of my distance. I'm not going to open up too much because of what could happen to me. People could injure me, or they could betray me or hurt me. And then third, consider this, or we may give up on pursuing friendship altogether. This is a little extreme, but I've actually heard some of this. We can give up on pursuing friendship altogether, thinking that it's just not possible to have the kinds of friendships that we long for. And this is a bad place to be. So none of these are really good approaches. You need good friendships where you work, live, and play. The health of your ministry is dependent on good friendships. And this is what I want to persuade you with a little bit. The health of your ministry is dependent on good friendships. I can tell you personally that right now I could not be planning a church if I didn't have the friendships, the support system, and structure. And it's not even all that intentional, but the men that I have in my life to encourage me and to be a well that I could draw encouragement from. But even in the context of my own local church, I have some good friendships. They're sweet. And Jesus made it that way, that the health of our ministry is dependent on good friendships. He made it that way so that we can model to our churches, to the people in our congregation, what it looks like to be a good friend. Because friendship, being a good friend, is really being like Jesus ultimately. It's part of what we should have and be in order to equip the body for the work of ministry, because discipleship does not happen without friendship. And we can't lead people to where we ourselves haven't been before. So we need friendship not only to have effective and healthy ministries, we need good friendship to be healthy enough to do ministry. Okay, let me say that to you again. We need friendship not only to have effective and healthy ministries, we need good friendships to be healthy enough to do ministry. So this is what I want to encourage us today, and this idea that friendships are like a well of water for us as pastors to draw the encouragement necessary for a lifetime of faithful ministry. The awesome thing about a well, like this picture of a well that I've had as I've been preparing for this, is that it's a renewable source, right? It rains, groundwater fills the well. It doesn't run out. It's always there. You can turn to it whenever you need refreshment. And I know that my friends are like that, man. I get on the phone and I call them. And after the end of that, at the end of that tail end of that conversation, I feel encouraged and I feel renewed and I feel refreshed and I have vigor. And I'm reminded of the good news of the gospel. And I'm reminded that I'm loved in a very tangible and practical way. Good friendships are like this. God gave us friendship as a source of encouragement. It's a special sort of unique place to practice giving and receiving. To practice lifting up and then being lifted up. Ecclesiastes 4:9-11, I'll put it on the screen for you, says this: two people are better off than one, for they can help each other succeed. If one person fails, the other can reach out and help, but someone who falls alone is in real trouble. Likewise, two people lying close together can keep each other warm, but how can one be warm alone? Guys, don't cuddle with your friends, by the way. It's not what this is saying. If you have wives, cuddle with them. A person standing alone can be attacked and defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer. Three are even better, for a triple braided cord is not easily broken. So in spite of all this, God did not, this is sweet, right? This is great. This is a good picture of companionship and friendship and what we have when we have good friends. In spite of all the good that this verse and this passage teaches, God did not intend to give you, through friendship, certain things that we all long for. God did not intend for friendship, for example, to give us the security, because friendships could be a source of comfort and security. God did not intend for friendships to give us that security that only Jesus can offer through the gospel. It's easy to run to our friends in times of trouble. I know this is my tendency. I don't want to project that upon you, but it's easy to run to them in times of trouble, doubt, confusion. Even like, I know that sometimes I don't know what to do. I'll call Brian. You know, I'll call my friend. The first person that I often run to is my wife. And a while back, I was feeling a little discouraged about life. You know, I wasn't seeing the fruit that I wanted to see. I'm like, I don't know, where's the fruit? There should be a trail of fruit behind me. I don't see it. I was questioning everything and just not being happy about where I was at in life and ministry and just a lot of different things. So we're sitting in the car one day. We're running errands. We're on a date night. I asked my wife, hey, so where do you want to go today? Shouldn't have done that. I should have planned it, but that's why I was in this session. We were sitting in the car, and we were in front of a store, some Office Depot store, stuff she had to pick up, and she said to me, I was telling her about how I was feeling and just being dissatisfied in life and not liking what I'm seeing, and she says to me, it seems that you see your life as an equation, and you don't like the answer, Sam. It's like, man, she read my number. And she said, remember when Jesus was hanging on the cross and all the people were down below looking at him? There were all kinds of different people there, people who wanted to kill him, people who were mocking him, the Roman soldiers, and then the people who loved him, his mother, his friends. There were all sorts of people down below looking up to Jesus as he's hanging on the cross. And they must have thought, clearly they must have thought, man, his life doesn't add up. This doesn't make sense to me. If Jesus' life was an equation, it didn't make sense. And she says, the same is true for you because your life is hidden with Christ in God. You have a high priest who knows your pain. That's why your life doesn't make sense. And you don't like the answer to your life's equation. And I thought, man, she brought some good news right now. That was good. That really administered to me deeply. I felt like I was repenting in the moment. And that's an example of why I want to turn to her. And when our friends encourage us like that, that's an example of why we want to turn to our friends, because we derive that kind of encouragement from them. She's awesome. But she can't give me the security in life that I long for. She can't be my savior. She can't be my rescuer. And I bring her up because she's my best friend. And this is an example of what good friendships do. They point you to our most faithful friend. They point you to Jesus. Two, vulnerability is what gives friendships the potential of being great. But being guarded removes the possibility of being truly known. You're never going to have the kind of friendships that you long for and that I long for unless we're willing to let down our guard. For the longest time, part of my story is that I wanted to prove myself as a kid. I come from an immigrant family, raised in Los Angeles City proper, and I wanted to prove myself. I didn't want anybody to see me for who I truly was or how incapable I felt or whatever insecurity I was dealing with. And I really wrestled with friendships because of that. I didn't want to let down my guard. And I was carrying all sorts of wounds in life, and I didn't want to let down my guard because I didn't know who I could trust or whether I'd be betrayed. See, friendships will not feel like the balm, like this balm of encouragement that we long for unless we're willing to put our wounds on the table. Unless we're willing to say, man, I'm broken right here, man. I don't know what to do right now. Or this thing that I went through really hurt. Friendships won't really satisfy us that way, unless we're willing to be open and take the mask off or whatever analogy we want to use. Now, this idea really flows out of the gospel, right? Because the gospel is only good news for people who recognize their sinfulness. Or else it's just like, yeah, it's not all that much. That healing balm of the gospel only soothes those who have been cut and who've been wounded. That's why when it's applied, it feels good. It soothes. And the same is true for friendships. They're only sweet and satisfying, and they're like this healing balm for us if we're vulnerable, if we're open about our wounds. And so the value, vulnerability and not being guarded brings value to a friendship. It strengthens a friendship. Another thing, three, we'll never have the kind of friendships that we long for unless we cultivate friendships where our friends can be honest. Where our friends can be honest and straightforward without fear of tanking the friendship. Do you have friends? Do your friends, can they speak to you and can they say things to you that what they really, but they may not be right, but they're being honest. Can you receive that in a way without feeling betrayed or hurt or rejected? Now, I get that a lot of it is how we do it, right? How we communicate these things, but the kind of friendships that we want, I know the kind of the friendships that I want are the ones where, like, people can be honest with me and tell me what they really think. And I could listen to it without being defensive, and I'm listening to understand and not just to defend. Four, a pastor needs friends. Simple, but I want to remind, a pastor needs friends. We all need friends, but we're talking about the value of friendships for a pastor. Pastor needs friends. Pastors know a lot of people. I know I go up to a Starbucks or I go to a restaurant or I wait on somebody or I go see the doctor, the urgent care, whatever. And I see somebody I know because I've been in my city for a long time. The church that I'm planning is only a couple years, but I've lived in that city for a long time before I moved to Washington. And when I go to the Starbucks, like, hey, you're Sam Tekus, right? And like, I was like, it's weird. But yeah, I feel like I know a lot of people. And I do, and I think a lot of you probably know a lot of people. Pastors know a lot of people, but not many people know them. There's a difference. And I think that we can fool ourselves into thinking that we have friends because we have people we see regularly, people that know us, people that we work with, etc. But if the relationship is not guided by some of these things like honesty, straightforwardness, vulnerability, these things that I'm talking about, they're not friends. They're just acquaintances. A pastor needs friends. Five, it is vital, I already alluded to this, it is vital for our ministry that we have the kinds of friendships that are life-giving. Life-giving friendships. I talked about this already some. We need friendships to have a healthy ministry and to be healthy enough to do ministry. Man, I can't tell you how important this is. It's been really important for me. Six, it is vital for our spiritual and emotional health that we have the kinds of friendships that are life. I just said that to you, didn't I? Why is that a repeat there? It's really important. But let me address those of you that are going to plant a church or that are planning a church right now, because that's kind of the context that I'm in right now. The rest of you, you're screwed. For those of you that are going to plant a church or are planning a church right now, man, church planning is a lonely experience. Here's what I mean. I don't want you to get me wrong. Like, there's plenty of people around all the time, or else you're not doing your job. But church planning is a lonely experience. No one knows, and this is because no one knows the weight that you carry. Like, we carry this weight. We could talk about whether or not you should carry that weight. Are you trusting in Jesus, bro? Like, Jesus builds his church. I get that. But I'm saying we still, because we're human, we still take on this weight. You're alone in that. That's what I mean by church planting is a lonely experience. You're alone in that. Nobody else really, and then this is not me puffing myself up or I'm tooting the horn of a church planter. Man, we're just, nobody knows our pain. I'm not saying that. Like, there's a unique way. Maybe if you're planning a church as a team, which we set out to initially, it didn't work out that way. That's a story for another day. But you take this weight upon yourself, good or bad, whatever the case may be. You take this weight upon yourself and nobody else really understands that, feels that. You need relationships that'll lift you up when that weight is too much. If you don't have these kinds of friendships, man, go get them. Your spiritual and emotional health will suffer. And the thing that you ultimately want to do, you won't stand a chance. Seven, sustaining and cultivating lifelong friendships is a joy and it's also a discipline. Okay, it's a joy and a discipline. And here's what I mean. If you're very independent like me, I feel like I'm very independent. It doesn't mean that I'm good or I can do everything by myself. It just means that I think I can. If you're very independent like me, you have to discipline yourself to seek your friends. You know, I'm going to use this example here because, man, Brian calls me more than I call him. And I'm grateful for that. Because it's pride on my, I don't want to call Brian. I don't want him to think I'm needy. I don't know what I'm doing or... This is part of being vulnerable, right? Me picking up the phone is me being vulnerable and me being letting my guard down. But see, when you do that, when you discipline yourself to seek your friends, even though if you're independent like me, when you do that, you're admitting your need. You're recognizing your need. The joy of friendship You know, when friendships feel so good, I don't want you to think that friendships are they're not mechanical, but there's and sometimes there are ways, for whatever reason, there are times when we have to discipline ourselves to continue to cultivate that friendship. The joy of friendship is the result of being faithful to regularly seek out your friends for the sole purpose of cultivating your relationship. That's where that sweetness comes out. That's when you enjoy that pure nectar of the relationship. 8, the key to traveling through life with longtime friends is recognizing your need to be deeply known. See, if you're under 30, I don't know that you may understand this or not. Maybe it's just me because I'm whacked. I grew up in a foster family, moved 18 times up until the time I was 18. I didn't live with a parent, you know, from the time I was 13 years old. I lived with my older brother who was only 5 years older than me. And so there's the fact that I'm like halfway decent, okay, I got things somewhat put together, is just a sign of God's grace. But the key, and I say that because I really didn't understand like the value of cultivating long-term friendships. I mean, I moved, I was at one place for a year, and then I was uprooted, I was out. And then I had to go do the same thing over again. And I think maybe that's why I like being around people and starting new friendships. So I didn't really understand the value of long-term friendships. And if you're young, if you're in your 20s, you may not understand the value of long-term friendships. But I think there'll come a point in time, especially for us pastors, because we're mobile, like we move around. Like so a lot of us have been in different parts of the country and different regions. Man, we need long-term friendships. And the way that we're going to recognize the importance of it is when you recognize your need to be deeply known and to be known for a long time. Because you will change throughout the years. It's what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, is change. Change is is par for the course as a Christian. You're not going to be the same person tomorrow that you are today. So as a result of that, you're going to long for friends. You're going to need to be, maybe you won't long for them, but you're going to have a need for people to know you over the course of years. People that have known different iterations of you throughout the years. People that know you deeply. So when you recognize this, when you're like, man, I really need to have people that I can travel with through life that have seen me at different stages of my life and kind of they can follow that thread of my story or know different motifs or different things that I've struggled with throughout the years, that's valuable. When you recognize your need to be known like this, you're not ever going to see friendships as just as disposable or seasonal. I used to see friendships like that. Like, that was just a friendship for a season. I'm done. And it's true. Some friendships are like that. But I guess what I'm trying to tell you here is, man, value having lifelong friendships. Seek them out. Make that a priority in life. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up with a couple of pieces of advice and a couple of action items. This is highly subjective. It's not like I exegeted some passage of scripture and like, this is what the passage teaches. It's not like that. This is kind of what, to some extent, is what I'm thinking through friendship and what the Spirit put on my heart. So I don't know if this is for you or not. Maybe this was for me. Here it is anyway. Here's some advice. Look for friendships that present you with opportunities to bless and not only be blessed. I say that because I'm selfish. I'm like, who's going to, that person, that could be this for me. That could be good. So look for friendships that present you with an opportunity to not only be blessed, but also to bless. And then, I don't know if you suffer from this, but sometimes, maybe it's because I'm still a newbie at this. I've been a pastor for 10 years. Like, I need to grow up in a Brian Howard. Stop trying to be everybody's friend. Sometimes I feel the weight of trying to be everybody's friend. And it's crushing, man. There will always be somebody in need. I was just sharing this with somebody who was telling me, man, I left so much work to do. It was a miracle I made it to Dallas, and there's just so much work, and I didn't finish all my stuff, and I feel like that all the time. And I think recently, at some point, I heard somebody say this, but it's been on my mind. You know when Jesus, in John chapter 17, you know, he begins that chapter by saying, he begins his prayer by saying, Father, I've completed all the work that you gave me to do. Man, there were still people who needed to be healed. There were still people who had leprosy. There were still people who were broken. There was tons of stuff left to do. But Jesus, with confidence, could say, man, I finished all the work that my Father gave me to do. God didn't give him everybody to fix in his 3 years of ministry. I mean, the cross ultimately is going to fix everyone. But I think the same is kind of true with, we can't be everybody's friend. We can't do it all. And even among the disciples, Jesus had closer relationships with some than he did with others. We see that, right? I don't want to read too much into that. We don't know the extent of it, but we see that even in Jesus' life. All right, here's some action items that I think would be helpful for you, regardless of where you're at in terms of friendship, whether you have amazing lifelong friendships or whether you have some, you know, you're on the beginning end of this. Identify the two or three friendships. Maybe you have more. I just don't know how you're going to do that. But identify the two or three friendships in your life that can provide you with a well of encouragement to draw from for life and ministry. Who are the people in your life? This is you going, these are the people in my life that I've really been blessed by. And I really feel like I can turn to these people. They minister good news to me. They point me to Jesus. These are people that I can be vulnerable with. I want to let my guard down in front of them. I trust them. They're not going to be perfect. But identify those two or three friendships in life for the purpose of you being intentional to continue to cultivate those friendships. And then identify some friendships where you can clearly function as an encourager and commit to doing so. Friendship is symbiotic. Ideally, these friendships will all be the same, right? Those where you derive encouragement and you give encouragement to as well. That's what friendship should be. Sometimes it's not always that case. I know I have friendships where I feel like I'm getting more than I am giving for whatever reason. So we have to be intentional about this. God made you for both sides of the friendship, giving and receiving. And then Josh and Adam yesterday, they stole a couple of my lines yesterday when they said, don't latch yourself to idiots, latch yourself to quality. Man, I really like that. I'm taking that as my own. Don't latch yourself to idiots, latch yourself to quality men, and then never undo it is what Josh said. Here's the thing. In order for you to never undo those good, long-time friendships, you have to keep it tight. You have to keep it tight. Ask yourself, what are you going to do to deepen, to tighten, and to triple cord braid your good friendships? All right? That's all I got for you. Let's pray. Father, we're thankful for Jesus' friendship to us because we know that he no longer calls us anything but friends. We're friends of his because of the cross. We're friends of him because of your gracious love for us that has saved us, has won us over, has opened our eyes to see the good news of the gospel, to see Jesus for who he truly is, and to see ourselves in a new light. Father, we ask that you would help us. We need friendships. We need friendships that minister good news to us. We need friendships that call us to love people the way that you've loved us. We need it those friendships to be a well of encouragement for us to draw from for a lifetime of faithful ministry to you. We pray that you would give that to us. We believe that in faith. In Jesus' name, amen.
We have 22 minutes left, so don't leave because the last 22 minutes are important, okay? I want to say before we're going to take some questions right now. If you want to do that, we can devote 10 minutes or so to that. But I want to say to you guys, when I left Los Angeles and moved to Louisville, Kentucky 6 years ago, like we hopped in our 2004 Ford Expedition, drove across the country, all excited, got to Louisville and thought, where are we? This is not where we live. What are we doing here? And we had a vibrant ministry and dived into community, but we got 6 or 8 months in and we were like, man, this is a different America than we know. Sojourn Church is amazing. We love the worship music. Mike Cosper is one of my closest friends. He's the worship pastor back there, Daniel Montgomery. But I remember calling Sam on the phone going, Sam, I don't know what should we do? What are we doing? How do we, live in Kentucky. Like, what is this, man? You know, there's no Dodgers here. And so, you know what Sam would do? He would get on a plane and fly out is what he would do. Or he would send Dina on a plane to fly out. And they flew out 3 times to Kentucky when we lived there to just go, hey, we'll come out there. We'll care for you. We'll love you. We'll pay for it. Like, he doesn't have any money. He's a church planner. I mean, they like, and so I didn't ask him to speak today because he's my friend. I asked him to speak today because I think he really gets this. And so I want to encourage you. You know, we heard this from Josh and Adam similarly yesterday. I want to encourage you. It's really important for you to have friends like Sam Tekus and for you to be a friend like Sam Tekus. All right, so that's a really good word. So we've got 10 minutes here, and we can both interchangeably speak to these things. Our families are very close. Our kids all hang out together. Our wives took our daughters to the Rose Bowl parade last year together in Los Angeles. And so, you know, we can, if you want to ask either one of us any questions about family, Sam has no business being as good of a dad and his husband as he is, coming out of the background that he came from, but he is. So anything you want to ask us about family, marriage, friendship, we'll take 10 minutes if you have anything you want to ask. And if not, we'll go on to 829. Carlos, let me repeat the question, then you want to start with that. So how many people, let's say you have four or five kids, you have the demands of family. How many friends can you really, like, how do you have the time to really invest deeply in friendships? What would you say to that, Sam?
And some of the things that come to mind are like, try to do things together. So for example, like, I'll take my son Mason. You know, when you're talking about balancing family and friendships, how do you make the time for all that? I'll take my son Mason to go help my friend Josh do something. I'll take my kids along to places and stuff like that. That's one of the ways that I do that. It's easier when you have, like, our kids, my kids and Brian's kids are same stage of life. They're all great friends. We're all great friends. Sometimes in life, things click like that. I think you want to try. I mean, my best advice to you is to say, what are the natural opportunities that I have to cultivate friendships like that, where things just kind of fall in line like that, and really work at being good at those kinds of friendships?
This would be my answer for you, Carlos. Sam and I live 70 miles, 2 to 3 hours drive through LA apart. I live on the very south of LA. He lives north of LA. I probably see Sam about 8 times a year, 10 times a year. We probably spent about the last 10 or 15 Thanksgivings together as families. They usually come to our house or we go to their house for Thanksgiving. But I don't see him that often. And it'll be, you know, a month or two. Like, I was just gone speaking somewhere, and Chandra took all the kids up to the Tekus's, and they were texting me videos online of all the kids playing Dance Revolution or something. I don't know. Like, they were hanging out as families, but we don't have a ton of time. We're not every day having coffee together. It's that we've been friends for so many years that we don't have to see each other all the time. So my answer would be, like, my season's not unlike yours. My son's graduating from high school this year, our oldest, so your kids are a little older, but you know this is intense. Like, you got five adults in you have six adults in your family. Once your youngest is 10 or 11, it's like they're all adults at that point, especially because your youngest, who's 10 or 11, is really like 15 because she's the youngest, right? So I would say you got to know your seasons. You know how you have these rich relationships oftentimes when you first get married, or it's because you don't have anything to do but go out and hang out every night with friends. Well, now it's like, you mean I have to go to another marching band concert? You got to be kidding me. Watch them salute each other and everything? What is that? You know, so, but I would say long-term friendships. So I would say it's hard, but you just need to know, is there a person or two? Is there a person or two that I have? And then those long-term friendships, you know, when I come to, Sam and I room at everything together. Every time we go to, not at the Gaylord. At the Gaylord, I put
this
him with.
The exception.
I appreciate that, Josh. At the Gaylord, I put him with my assistant, Ben Clifford, back there in the back. So, but I mean, Sam and I, we look for opportunities to go to stuff together, to room together. We went to lunch today, and I don't have to counsel Sam or wrestle with, because we just, it's just so long term. Somebody else. How does the gospel inform friendship? I'm going to turn it over to Sam, who's taught Soma 101, 201, 301, 401, 501, 601, and 701.
Hey, Jim, that's a great question, man. You know, the passage that comes to mind is Philippians 2, when Paul says, hey, don't only look to your own interest, but look more so to the interest of others. And then later on, I think it's in verse 11, he says, this is the mind of Christ. So what we see in the gospel is that Jesus felt so secure and who he was and loved and accepted by the Father, that he could give himself away in such a way that he wasn't primarily looking to his own need, He was looking at the needs of others. And that's the mind of Jesus. And I mean, that's what I believe. That believing that up here and then actually working that out here is a different story. But I think it begins there. And so I would just ask you, like, do you believe that our dad's a good dad to you and that he's going to give you everything that you need? Because if so, that if you're relying on that, then you're not going to see potential friendships for what they can give you. You're going to see potential friendships for how you can also contribute.
I will tell you, too, let me just say, if you want to have good friends, you have to be a good friend. I mean, there's a Bible verse about that, right? So I can say that, all right? But still, the best way for you to build, first of all, it takes a long time to build friendships. I'm 45. The older I get, the more I feel like it takes a lot of years. I just read an article that Russell Moore posted the other day on The Atlantic about The Atlantic Monthly about how difficult it is to build friendships once you get into your 40s and 50s. Basically, what the article said is that it said we're really flexible when we're young. Someone's like, I don't like that restaurant. You're like, all right, cool, let's go to a different restaurant. But, you know, like, we know what we want when we get older. And friendships get harder. Relationships are complicated. My wife doesn't like your wife. You raise your kids differently. There's all kinds of stuff out there. So if you want to have good long-term friendships, the best way to do that is to give yourself away your whole life. Okay?
Go ahead, Adam.
Alan, then Adam. I'm going to say that out loud so it can get on the recording. So Alan said the harder part for him is not so much giving, because you're giving all week long, but actually putting yourself in a position where you can receive friendship and allow yourself to be served. Thanks, Alan, for that. Adam.
Yeah, man, that's a really good question. Brian alluded to something that's really key. Like, I could be really good friends with somebody and then not have my wife be good friends with his wife. And so things like that happen oftentimes. And so I think you have to really cultivate. I mean, I'll go back to our friendship and go, man, when you have that, like when you have, I know you guys are great friends all around. When you have that, that's just special, man. You got to, and you know, and it's kind of one of those things where I wish everybody could have that, you know, but you always got to go, man, what could I do to encourage my wife in friendships? How do you work for you men here, like most of your men, but how do you work in such a way that you can encourage that kind of friendship for your wife, make time for it, make space for it in life? My wife has actually a really good friend in our city. She's not a part of our church. She's a Christian, goes to another church. She worked with her. She taught with her for a year. A great friendship. Like, they really enjoy each other. She wants to go hang out with her. I'm always trying to figure out what I can do to encourage that kind of friendship.
How do you discern the difference between safe and unsafe friendships?
That's a really good question. I was just talking to my daughter about this. she was having an issue, and the 14-year-old girls do joke fights, apparently. I don't know if you heard this. Like, they start texting each other, and they're mad at each other, but it's all a big joke. But my daughter's really serious, like, what's going on here? My friendship's falling apart. And one of the things that I told my daughter was, like, are these friendships, like, friendships where do you feel like that give you encouragement? Are they friendships that honor, you know, and some of these girls aren't Christian, but do they honor God? Our friendships? Are they God-honoring relationships? Are they friendships that, you know, again, point us to Jesus? I'll come back to that. I mean, that's what comes to mind, Adam.
Okay, I'd love for us to go longer, but we can't. We're almost out of time, and I want to give you a bit of an announcement I want to give you, we've got 9 minutes until we're done, and so what I want to do is I want to give you just a brief update. Two of our network leadership team are here, and Hunter is teaching another session right now, probably hugging with Mark Halleck on the stage somewhere. So what I want to do is I've been doing these in our region, the Pacific West region. I've been doing these town hall meetings for our pastors. We have 53 churches in our region, and for those of you in the Mountain West region or the Northwest region, you're connected way more to Hunter and Josh and Carrie and those guys, and so you know the folks in your region. And so, but what I wanted to say to you is that the four of us, when I say the four of us, me, Hunter, Harvey, and Josh, the network leadership team, are collaborating together. First of all, we all love each other and have good friendships and relationships. I mean, God's really shown our network favor in the sense that we don't have any tension among us. in that if we could choose who we would want to work with, these are the guys. You know, they chose me to be the guy to be in this role. They chose me. They said to Steve, we want Brian to be in this role. And then I didn't have to choose them because they were in these three spots already, but I would have chosen these three guys and said, this is the best representation for who we want to work together, who I want to work with. Now, so what I wanted to say to you is that there's a lot of questions, and we don't have a lot of opportunities to answer all of the questions all the time. So I'm just going to give you a quick briefing, and then Matt Chandler is going to talk about this a bit tomorrow, but I'm not sure exactly how he's going to do it or how it's going to go. You realize that our three regions have been joined into one network. Now, it's not that you've lost your regional identity. We still have regions. It's that it used to be that your region was connected to the United States. Okay, so then for years and years, we all, you know, we went to different things all over the country because we were Acts 29 North America or whatever. What happened in the last year is that the Acts 29 board made the decision to say we have 450 American Acts 29 churches. We don't really, there's no way to hire one person to oversee all 450 churches. Let's have five networks across the country. And then Josh and Harvey and Hunter and I were part of the team to build that out. Okay, well, how do we split up the United States? Well, we don't want Oklahoma, right? So push them over there, right? So anyway, so what we did, you better stop the tape, Ben, and I'm serious. You really better stop the tape. So we, and I'm